So hello, and let's start out by doing the prayers.
Okay.
Maybe take, again, I always have to remind myself to just pause a minute, because otherwise, I think many of us don't like ritual anyway. And we see prayers as being part of ritual, and therefore, we have some kind of resistance toward it. But we understand why we're doing it and the benefits of it. Not only are we planting seeds in our mind, but if we're motivated in the right way and we think about it, what are we taking refuge in, then it means something to us, and it can set our mind on the right path for meditation. As Venerable Rabina has said on multiple occasions, at least I've heard her say it, we're mainly motivated by self-interest, aren't we? I mean, we are. 99.999999% of what we do until we realize emptiness is at some level or another has some kind of self-interest as a source of the motivation. So, and it's okay. His Holiness sometimes calls it enlightened self-interest, because here we're taking refuge and generating bodhicitta. We're taking refuge out of fear or dread of consequences of our crazy mind being unleashed for the rest of our lives and countless future lifetimes and all the carnage that it'll create. So we don't want that. So we dread that. We don't want that. And we have confidence that the Buddha Dharma and Sangha can actually guide us. And then of course, bodhicitta is this, really based on compassion, a sense of universal compassion for all living beings. And it's based on sincere, loving love and kindness, a sincere sense of connection and love, toward these other beings. That's the only way we could ever really develop true compassion. We're not going to develop it for people we dislike. So here we are. The first two lines are, talking about, distinguishing us from non-Buddhists as Buddhists. And the second two lines are really distinguishing our motivation for the practice. So I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. And may all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. And you might add indifference towards strangers. Then the short mandala offering. This ground anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon. I imagine this as a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Radha Mandala Kamniyata Yami. So let's start out start out doing taking a couple of deep cleansing breaths and settle in to your chair or your cushion or wherever you're however you're sitting. I happen to be sitting in a chair. I'm not sure I'll ever be able to cross my legs again. I have artificial parts in my knee now, but anyway, it's okay. So settle into a comfortable posture, however how you're sitting. And relax, you know, your shoulders can be sort of down and back a little bit. You want your head in alignment with your spine if possible, and your chin a little tucked in, tongue on the roof of your mouth, eyes either slightly closed or slightly open. Sometimes we open the eyes. Later on in meditation practice, it's good to be able to have the eyes just slightly open so some light can come in. So it has the it can make us more alert. And then just notice that you're sitting. Just feel your body sitting in this comfortable posture. We'll start out by just watching the breath, and there are many ways to do that. You can just go out and in, out and in, out and in, out and in. Out and in. Out. You can softly note this in your mind. In. And keep going like that. Out and in. Each time your mind is distracted, bring it back to the experience of breathing out and in. And each time we catch ourselves being distracted, and we just bring a mind back again and again, that is the practice. That is the practice of paying attention, being aware, being mindful of the content of our experience. And in this particular practice, we're bringing the mind back again and again to the breath. As soon as we notice that we've been taken away by some monologue or some little entry into our mental diary, we bring the mind back. Now we're going to shift gears a little bit and continue to be mindful of the breath, but allow whatever arises in the mind to arise and just notice whatever's coming up. And for example, if some strong emotion arises, or even if it's just a thought, or feeling, we can just mentally, just very softly note that. For example, if we're thinking mentally, with a very soft note, go thinking. When we do that, and see what happens. See what happens to the thoughts. And when we're ready, we can come back to the breath. Some strong emotion like anger or lust or fear, something like that arises in the mind, that's also can become the object of our awareness without getting involved in it, and you know, without becoming completely consumed by it. We just gently note, for example, lust or desire, just softly note that. Maybe it's fear. We're fearful that we won't be able to make our house payment or our car payment, or we're fearful for our health. We're fearful of whatever it might be. Again, we can mentally note that. Very softly, fear. Again, notice what happens as we simply note whatever it is that we're experiencing. sometimes you can just stick with the, you know, just the noting when, like when your mind is a lot of conceptual thoughts are coming up. You can just, thinking is a nice generic way to note, but maybe it's even more specific. You want to be more specific, or you might go planning. Very soft mental note, planning. Or we might experience pain in the body. Could be in your knees right now, your neck, your back, wherever that is. Whatever's dominating your awareness at the moment. And just without pushing the experience away, open to it, and simply note what you're experiencing, like knee pain or back pain or neck pain. 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 If you're drowsy or sleepy, meditation practice, and that can become the object of your of focus or your meditation, like simply noting sleepy, and you experience in your body. And your mind, what that feels like as you note it sleepy. Or bored. That's a common one. Bored. And now bring your attention to the sounds in the room. And simply note lightly, just listening or hearing. One thing is pretty obvious is that the mind is always in the body, of course, but the mind is what we're using as our point of focus, is always in a state of change, moment to moment. The Dalai Lama says a great yogi or meditator is someone who's focused on the next moment of awareness with clarity, the next moment of consciousness with clarity and awareness. A great yogi is someone who's focused on the next moment of consciousness with clarity and awareness. Can't focus on this moment because it's already gone, isn't it? It's just the next moment, completely open to this, the flow of the mind, the impermanence of the subtle impermanence of our consciousness from moment to moment. And then we think, you know, how satisfying is it to have a mind that it's literally, if we think about it, we have virtually no control over our mind. Particularly when we sit in meditation and we can't even count to 10, it becomes vividly clear that, we might want to think we, and sometimes we do, but majority of the time we don't. And is that satisfying? Does that bring tranquility and peace, knowing that our mind is out of control? You know, clinging to everything that's delicious, our addiction to deliciousness, which creates an aversion to whatever is not delicious. And then in the middle of all of this, just constantly flux of mind, where is the I, the self? We can't find it. All we can find is an uninterrupted flow of moments of consciousness. There's no place where you can posit, oh, right there's the self. No, because it's already changed. It's already changed. There is no self when we start to look at the flux of our momentary changes of body and mind. There is no self that we can identify in that moment. It's already changed. Okay, you can relax your consciousness, bring your attention back in the room. Any questions about any?
Don, we didn't have questions that I see, but there was some of us were having a hard time hearing you. So it may be that perhaps you need to be closer to your computer. I'm not really sure.
Okay.
I have a question. No one else does, they can go first.
You're good, Julie. Go ahead.
Okay. So my question is, when we're doing a practice and we have a visualization, either A, on top of our head or in front of our head here, or we might even have a visualization with our mala. I guess my question is the point of doing the recitations of the either the prayers or the like, say for the practice of the 31 prostrations to the Buddhas. So the visualization is you have all your past lives behind you, the Buddhas are up here, you're prostrating and purifying. Is the point to have a steady visualization and to know the text or either do mantras so that you have two steady objects so you can't oscillate and have another thought sneak in between your mantra and your visualization?
The question was, give me the last part because I thought
okay, I'll try. If you've got a real steady visualization and you're doing mantras like Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum,
and you're visualizing Shinrezig in front of you,
right?
With an arm Shinrezig.
So is the reason you have a steady meditation and the mantras at the same time is to keep yourself from having, sometimes when I'm doing mantras, if I don't have a steady visualization, other thoughts will sneak in because there's so many thoughts in a moment. Right. So my question is, if you have a good visualization and you are focused on your mantras, is that to keep you from oscillating or these thoughts from getting in there in between, or you're being distracted and letting that thought in?
Yeah.
It might not be a question. I'm not sure.
No, I mean, that's a good point. For example,
So, Don, it's still hard, difficult to hear you, and I'm not sure why. So we were able to hear Julie quite easily.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, that's better.
Maybe I just need to speak up. Hang on a minute. Anyway, I've got it unmuted.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, well, I'll just get up here close. I need a microphone, I guess.
Right.
Uh-oh, my light just went out. Anyway, Nav's really getting good. I lost everything. Here we go. Now I'm back. No, I think that's a good point. When, for example, when you do a Vajrasattva mantra, okay, and you're trying to visualize, see, this is why Tantra is so hard to do because, I mean, it takes incredible powers of concentration and mindfulness and so forth to, for example, you know, I got my mala here, had it for a long time, and let's say you're gonna you want to do the 100 syllable mantra, which is a lot of syllables, right? Mm-hmm. And you want to do that all the time. You're sitting perfectly still. You're trying to be aware of your body, right?
Mm-hmm.
Your mind's eye is focused on. If we're talking about Tantra, in purification practice, we're talking about, your mind's eye is focused on the deity. If it's Vajrasattva, it could be Vajrasattva with consort or just Vajrasattva alone. But your mind is focused on this Buddha figure, which is completely made of light, like a hologram, and is the embodiment of all enlightened beings and inseparable from your guru. And you want to keep that in your mind all at the same time that you're doing the mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, or the 100-syllable mantra. It is huge. There's a lot going on. And it takes, that's why we start out with the first level of tantra is Kriya Tantra, where we just use either usually a visualized image in front of us, just one image like Chinrezi, either forearm or thousand arm, or green Tara, or Manjushri, or Vajrapani, whatever one we choose. It's just one deity, and then we're doing their mantra, and usually we're visualizing light and nectar coming from that deity entering our body. Maybe blue light, red light here for speech, and white light here for the body, and blue light coming in at the heart while you're saying the mantra of, say, Om Mani Padme Hum. So you're trying to do that, and the mantra is to help us stay focused. Actually, the name mantra is another name for mantra is mind protection. What is it protecting the mind from? Distractions. Okay? So there's some benefit to keeping your mind to doing mantras as you do these visualizations. But it's the idea is not to let thoughts interrupt. But of course they do. And when we recognize that we've been taken away by the thoughts, you come back. You just come back to the practice again and again and again. And that's kind of the, I don't know if anybody here has, maybe three or four years ago at the Catholic monastery in Durham, we did a retreat on Vajrasattva using the 100-syllable mantra. And probably maybe 25 people were there. And it's pretty hard to do. It's really hard to do, to keep your body still. So you're mindful of your body. You're mindful of what your is in your mind's eye. You're also mindful of the fact that you're purifying your body, speech, and mind. And you're mindful of your speech. So you're trying to be mindful of three things at one time. That is really hard to do. So, again, that's why Tantra takes a kind of a heroic effort. It's not simple. It's not like just watching the breath. Even that is hard enough. But Tantra, when it's done properly, takes a huge amount of effort, overtime, really. Usually people do tantric retreats, either a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks or 6 weeks or 3 months, whatever the practice might be. So, anyway, that answer your question?
I think that it did. Yes, I really like doing the visualizations. They do. They make your conscious even. They just make the practice better.
Mm-hmm.
So that you can visualize. I like the 31 prostrations. I like the Vajrasattva. I've never been to a retreat, but I do have the little purification book, so I can do the visualization. And I think Hemet taught me the visualization in the class, so I have him to thank for that.
Okay. Good. Yeah. I was going to say too that, well, for example, you know, we've been focusing in on the breath. We've used different objects of focus. We haven't used really any Buddha figures. For example, in there's one text, Tibetan text, on how to develop, you know, calm abiding. And the object that you use is a Buddha about, I don't know, maybe the size of your thumb, or it's small anyway. It's a body's, it's about 6 feet in front, at the level of your forehead, completely made of light. And your job is to focus all of your energy, and you want to have a clear vision, as clear as possible visualization of this enlightened being. And you also feel an enlightened presence. That it's not just some game we're playing, but there's an enlightened presence in that figure that we're seeing, and golden robes, smiling at us with a compassionate gaze, but very small and very bright. That keeps our mind alert. And we try to focus on that image of the Buddha. And you can try it right now for just a couple of minutes. Just right, body's length in front, about the size of your thumb, a Buddha. And just, you know, make the commitment to not let your mind wander at all for a second. You don't have to say any mantras. You just focus on that. And when we can do that for 4 hours, when we can focus for 4 hours on that Buddha figure without our mind wandering for even a second, and avoiding sinking and excitement, right? We haven't talked much about the obstacles to meditation, but those are the two big ones that we talk about in the Tibetan tradition. I mean, of course, there's boredom and things like that, but when you really get down to it, you know, when the mind is racing off thinking about, I want to do this and I want that, and, you know, that's excitement. That's the mind being excited by objects of desire, attachment, whatever it might be. And so we have to, sometimes it's very difficult to rein the mind in. Sometimes you can just be aware of the thoughts, like thinking, 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 and then you can bring the mind back. But sometimes it's really got us. And so one of the remedies for, you know, for excitement is to think about death and impermanence. Sounds kind of gruesome, but, you know, that will sober you up pretty quick. And then you can bring your mind back to the focus of whatever it is you're focusing on. And then maybe 10, 15, 20 minutes go by, and then you notice your mind sinking, like getting dull, and that kind of dullness, torporous kind of you know, you're really cultivating stupidity when you do that, when we do that. So we need to lift the energy of the mind. And so that we could, if we're not able to do that just by being aware of the fact that we, you know, become like I said, torpors and sinking, and the mind's getting distracted by this sort of not very sharp state of mind, we can actually do a little analytical meditation on the preciousness of this human life. Like, what an amazing opportunity we have. You know, this life is so precious because, well, hey, we were born a human, and, you know, we have all of our faculties. We're born at a time, at a place where, you know, we're not tormented because of our religious beliefs and so on. And we're born at a time when the Buddha's teachings exist, when a Buddha has descended and taught, and the living exemplars of the teachings, where these examples in our teachers and other great beings that can inspire us. So it's a really precious life. Our life is so precious. So we try to think like that to lift the mind up. And sometimes you just have to get up and stand up. Sometimes you just have to, okay, I'm lost. I need to just stand up and go get a drink of water and walk around and come back. So that's the thing. There are a lot of ways to combat the obstacles that meditators are going to run into day, you know, everyday. Any questions? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hello?
Yes.
Okay. Any other?
Yeah. Willis did comment. He says, it's weird. I have to visualize myself looking at the Buddha from the third person. I have a hard time visualizing it above me, but I can see me sitting and it over in front of me.
Okay. Sounds good to me.
It reminded me of, like,
focus on it.
You know how there's like the mind that is watching the mind? That it kind of reminded me of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, normally, usually we're, in Kriya Tantra particularly, there's, once you've had an initiation into a particular deity practice, say, for example, Tara, you've had an initiation into Tara, then what you can do, because, I mean, I've been teaching this introduction to Tantra class for a long time, so not that I'm qualified to teach it, but I just do. And so this is a practice that a lot of people do, and if you're attracted to that, to Tara practice, basically, you know, what you might do, you could visualize, you could have a front generation where you visualize Tara in front of you and completely made of light and as big as possible. You could do that. Or if you've had the initiation, the empowerment from a qualified teacher, you can actually see yourself as Tara. So to do that, what you have to do is motivated, obviously, by bodhicitta, by compassion and wisdom. And wisdom is really important here. Motivated by that, we see the emptiness of self and our ordinary. And usually, what people do is you visualize that you're getting smaller and smaller and smaller until you're the size of a, like, almost like a pea, and then you get smaller than that, like an atom, and then your physical body just completely disappears. And within this space, this is like completely spacious, the spaciousness Our mind, motivated by compassion and wisdom, emerges as green Torah. And we are, and we identify ourselves as Torah. And we, and if you do the vision, if you do it properly, you can see that you're green and the one leg is in and one leg is out, and you're holding the stem of a flower and you're holding a rosary, and, you know, beautiful, every feature with jewels and so on and so forth, all the details that you would see in a tanka or in an image of Torah. You imagine that that is you now. You imagine that you're Torah now. And then you can do mantra. You can do mantras. Om Tari Tu Tari Tari Soha. Om Tari Tu Tari Tari Soha. Om Tari Tu Tari Tari Soha. And imagine that your heart is a disc, and around the disc are the seats of the syllables of the mantra. And Hri is sitting in the center, and it spins around, and as you say the mantra, you visualize yourself as Tara. Now, and you think, again, this is based on what we call divine pride. You imagine that you are enlightened being now, capable of benefiting universal living beings in every kind of imaginable way. And again, you just continue to say the mantra. And as I said, mantra means mind protection. Mind protection. It's one of the other definitions of mantra. So as you're saying the mantra, you're protecting your mind from distractions. You're protecting your mind from negativities. So that's another way. We haven't done any mantra practice. We were going to do some tonight, just really briefly toward the end, do some purification practice. But yeah, this it takes a lot of concentration to keep all of that going on, not just the visualization, but what it means, what it symbolizes. And then it can be embellished. The visualization can be like even enhanced even more by imagining that from your heart, like countless green Taras go out in every direction. And they, you know, and they benefit sentient beings. They teach them the path to enlightenment. They guide them from where state of confusion they are all the way up to supreme happiness. And then these Taras come back and absorb to your heart. And then you send out more Taras and you bring them back. I mean, all of this can be done with awareness and with concentration. But as you can see, it takes a lot of effort. Not easy. It's a different style of Buddhist practice than just being simply mindful of the breath or mindful of thoughts, feelings, and so forth. It's a different game. But it's the Tantra is actually the heart of the Tibetan. I mean, it's a unique feature of Tibetan Buddhism. And it's said that we need to be able to, it's said it's much, you can develop concentration much more quickly in tantric practice than you can in sutra practice. So I won't say more about that, other than the fact that the teachings give pretty clear explanation for how that might be so. But that's a story for another day. What else? Anything else?
I'm not seeing any other questions. If anybody does have a question, feel free to unmute and ask.
I would say one other thing about your practice, your meditation practice. Just do it a day at a time. You know, it reminds me of If you say, oh, I'm going to meditate every day for the rest of my life, that's too daunting. That is just too much. But if you can think, I'm going to do it just today. You get up in the morning, today I'm going to do my practice, just one day at a time. Don't try to be a superhero. Just do it one day at a time and do it the best you can. And I said this before, it's better to do 10 minutes of really good practice. For example, particularly if you're doing concentration practice, but any of these meditations, don't go on for an hour. That's not helpful. You know, you can gradually build up to 15, 20, 25 minutes. 25 minutes is about as much as anybody can keep their mind on anything these days. I've read that. I think it's probably true. Having said that, it's been about 25 minutes. Let's take a break. And you can get up and walk around, and then we'll start back in about, I don't know, 5 minutes.
It's Linda. If you do want me to pull up the Vajrasattva 100 syllable mantra, I have it ready. If that's something you want to do this evening.
Do you have that little booklet that Lama Zopa did that Lama Yeshe Wisdom Archives?
I have it, but not with me right this moment. I would have to go search it out in a bookshelf.
I'm wondering if it's online though.
Oh yeah, I think it is.
Because that might be good. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've got my little book here, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, not everybody can see this. They don't necessarily have to, but
yes. The one that I have, I'll show you real quick. It's from the FPMT website. This one.
Okay. Then go down below. Is there a shorter mantra?
No.
Okay. Yeah.
I can probably find the short mantra. Oh, looks like John just put a link in the chat. Thanks, John.
Where is it?
You are. Oh,
yeah, so that is online. And John Kelly just put the little booklet. There's a link to it. Very nice.
Good. Well, that's something we can do here in a minute.
I'll show it to you real fast so you can see what it looks like.
Yeah. Perfect. I'm wondering if I can make it bigger.
And, you know, it goes on.
Yeah, that's really nice. It's a lot of information. Can you make it bigger on the screen? All right, that's good. I wish my screen was bigger, though. I don't know. Like top to bottom, I don't know how to make it bigger. You know, how normally you can just click something and it gets bigger.
What are you seeing on your screen right now? Do you see yourself or do you see all of us?
No, I just see myself to the right side, and then I see the mantra.
If you put your cursor, you can try this. I don't know if it'll work, but if you put your cursor in between your picture and the mantra, if a gray line comes up, you can click on that line and make yourself smaller and make the mantra bigger.
Okay.
I don't know if that'll, if you have that capability right now or not.
Yeah, I did a little bit. It worked. Didn't work as much as I wanted it to. Yeah, that's okay. It doesn't matter. All right.
Do you want me to keep sharing this or go ahead and stop sharing it now, for now?
You can take it down now for the moment. So I ask people those who were willing to. This was not the finest week of meditations, you know, in terms of uplifting things like the eight sufferings, the six sufferings, the causes of cyclic existence, factors that stimulate the arousal of mineral afflictions, and the paths that, well, here's a good one, the path that ceases disturbing attitudes, negative emotions, and karma. So let me ask some people here now, what are the benefits of meditating on dukkha, or what we talked about? I mean, we talked about the First Noble Truth, which is basically what these meditations have been about. The eight sufferings of human beings, the six sufferings of cyclic existence, the causes of cyclic existence, and so on. What are your thoughts about that? Anybody?
And feel free to either use chat or unmute.
Hey, Don.
Buddhism gets a bad rap, by the way, for being negative because of these kinds of teachings.
Don, I've always viewed it as setting your own expectations, setting the expectation that your life will be filled with ups and downs, that it will be filled with suffering, and that it's okay to suffer and to have a bad time. And we should expect that we run into hurdles big and small, and that not that we should desire to never have those hurdles, but we should desire to have the ability to gracefully overcome them.
Yeah.
That's my view.
I like one thing you said that really makes all of it made sense, but that thing of expecting suffering, like, it is what it is. We are caught in samsara, right? We're caught in this, what Buddhism calls this cycle of uncontrolled causation. That's kind of one professor, Jeffrey Hopkins, used to call it that. But it's, you know, that the circle of life where you're starts with ignorance and, you know, blah, 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 and then this, all the way to sickness and old age and death. It always starts with ignorance. Ignorance is what keeps us caught in this process of uncontrolled causation. And so to realize that when we're having a bad time, that there's nothing, in a sense, yeah, something's wrong because we're not having a good time, but there's nothing wrong. This is what we should expect in this world where we don't have a mind that we have control over. Now, here's the other part of it that's interesting, is that we're also identifying that which we can get beyond. So understanding suffering. We're not, it's not meant to bring us down and make us sad and feel, you know, yeah, to bring us down. It's actually, it actually should in some ways inspire us, because we're seeing the nature of cyclic existence, and we're also identifying that which we can get beyond. What does nirvana mean? It means the complete cessation of suffering. Nirvana. What causes, what is it, you know, what's the key to nirvana? Wisdom. That's how we get out of it. Suffering is develop wisdom. So it's kind of, you know, it's sort of great in a way to recognize these things. What are some of the other advantages of recognizing suffering?
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. So this is not as much that, more so going off of what you were saying previously and what I think John was saying, I'm pretty sure. But I think it's really interesting that a lot of people see suffering as such a bad thing, because I feel like it's something that we should definitely embrace more, and the more that we embrace it, I think we'll be able to overcome it easier. It's not, like you said, such a bad thing.
Well, let's look at the benefits of suffering, okay? When we suffer, what's in the moment we're suffering, what's actually happening? Why are we suffering? Because of
karma.
Karma.
Dependent
karma ripening. It's karma ripening. So when we experience suffering and that karma is ripening, it's finished. That karma that caused that suffering is finished. Now, if we react in a really negative way, well, we just create a whole nother round. But if we can have some tolerance and patience with our own suffering, that's a purification practice. Also, if we don't see our own suffering and the suffering of others, how can we ever develop compassion? Compassion is the wish that beings be free of suffering and its causes. So as Buddhist practitioners, we need to take a really good hard look at suffering and the depth of suffering that we and others are experiencing, and then wish, really sincerely wish, that may I be free of suffering and its causes. May I be free of suffering and its causes. That's renunciation, the determination to be free. It's also based on some recognition that it is possible to be free of suffering and its causes. Otherwise, why would you even say it? Well, you could wish it. But I mean, may I be free of suffering and its causes implies that you sort of believe it's possible. So we call that, in some ways we call that having compassion for yourself or renunciation. And then seeing other people suffering, you know, the depth of suffering of not, seeing the depth of other beings, not just human beings, but other beings as well, the kind of sufferings that they're going through. May they be free of suffering and its causes. You know, and sincerely believe that in our heart, have that come from our heart. Now, getting back to this whole thing about compassion, again, you have to start out with a mind of equanimity, don't you? You can't be like, may my friends and my family be free of suffering and its causes, but may all my enemies and everybody that annoys me, you know, when they suffer, I'm happy. You know, whoopee-doo. That doesn't work. We have to develop this mind of this equanimous mind, is equal regard for those that we're attached to, those that we feel indifference toward, and those we feel aversion toward. We need to these are all concepts that we have conjured up based on how these beings have treated me or I. And what we need to do is realize that they're all changeable, that they're not fixed, and develop an equanimous mind, realizing that everybody wants to be happy, nobody wants to suffer. We're all just like that. And then based on that, when we recognize suffering, you know, and Buddhism talks about stuff that you wouldn't even think about. Like, well, the obvious ones are birth, and anybody who's seen a baby born, or the mothers who've been involved in it, you know, no, it's not an easy trip for the mother or the baby. Birth, and then as we get older, we're all going to get sick. It's inevitable. I always amaze at people who tell me, "Oh, I never get sick." I'm going, just wait. Your time is coming. Then there's sickness. Then, if you're lucky enough, you get to age. I'm having that one right now, and you know it's interesting. You have to let go of a lot of the stuff that we used to think of as take for granted. As you get older, you can't. Your joints aren't as nimble. You can't do the things you used to like to do. You know, it's a whole process of letting go and aging. And we don't want to do that. We don't want to let go of our youthful look, the pleasures that we had in our youth, blah, 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 blah. We don't want to let go, but there is a suffering of aging and then death. And of course, I mean, that freaks nobody wants to, we don't even want to think about it. We don't even want to think about it. And in fact, I'm going to say, you don't even think you're going to die. Most of us, if we stop this moment and ask yourself, do you really think you're going to die? If you look deep, 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 deep down inside, that self-cherishing, egocentric sense of I feels like it's permanent. It will not die. There's a part of us that feels like it could never die. It's immutable. It's never going to die. But of course, when we think about it, yeah, nobody lives forever. Everybody dies. So there's birth, sickness, old age, and death. Meeting leads to parting, doesn't it? Always. High position leads to low position. All composite things must separate into their parts, and on and on. We have to be born again, again and again and again and again in cyclic existence, taking countless different forms. But each time, being born, getting sick, getting old, and dying, going through that process. Then we have to die again and again, taking a body. And then having to give it up every lifetime. You know, I remember Jeffrey Hopkins, he said, look at Mount Everest. Just think of all your former corpses, just the skeletons. Forget about the meat, but just the skeletons. A mountain made out of your skeletons would dwarf Mount Everest. That's how many times we've had to die. We've been through this whole countless cycle of birth and sickness and death and old age so, so many times. And we have to, so the point of this is for us to recognize the human condition in samsara, but also to have some determination to be free. If you're in jail and you think you're in paradise, do you want to get out? Heck no. If you think jail is paradise, you have no desire at all to leave. But when you realize that jail is jail and that you are trapped in a hopeless situation, really, but you can be free. You can be free. So that's the whole point. I love, you know, meditating on suffering. There are many benefits, right? There's the benefit of helping us develop compassion, not only for ourselves, but for other people. It helps us burn up as we suffer. The negative karmic seeds are expended, and so we don't have to face those consequences again. It helps us to, as I said, develop compassion, empathy for other people, realizing that there's nobody. I don't care how famous they are, how much money they've got. Everybody's going to have to go through this, has gone through, and will go through all of this stuff again. There's nobody that we have to be in awe of. Everybody's going to get sick, old, and die, and have to go through this ridiculous cycle of suffering again and again. So, what are the three principles? Children talked about the three higher trainings. Remember what they were? Anybody do that meditation?
Is that the one where she talks about ethics?
Yes.
And meditation, stabilization, and wisdom.
Exactly, exactly. Okay. She's the path that ceases karma. Wait a minute. Yeah. The path that ceases disturbing attitudes, negative emotions, and karma. So, let me see what time it is. Okay. They call it the three higher trainings. It's ethics, ethical self-discipline. That's why it's important to memorize, at the very least, to call yourself a Buddhist. You need to strive to avoid the 10 non-virtuous actions and to practice their opposite, the virtuous actions, right? So remember, we went over these last time. You have to memorize this stuff, unfortunately. All right. So the three of body are killing. And by the way, they go from the heaviest to the lightest. So the heaviest is killing. Then there's stealing. Then there's sexual misconduct. Those are the three of the body. The speech ones are lying, slander, harsh, and frivolous speech. And the three of mind are greed and hatred and ignorance. Sometimes it says covetousness and ill will, and it's always ignorance. Okay? Those are the three of mind. So those are the 10 non-virtuous actions that we need to avoid and try to practice their opposites. And this is a great mindfulness practice, because we have to be able to catch ourselves before we go down that rabbit hole. Because once we go down, it's hard to turn around and come back. So we have to be mindful of the things that we're committed to not doing. I'm committed to avoiding killing. I'm committed to avoiding stealing, sexual misconduct, lying, slander, harsh, frivolous talk, greed, hatred, ignorance. We try to really wrap our mind around it. And I said at one point in this class, two-thirds of the Buddhist teachings are based on ethics, the teachings on ethics. Isn't that wild? Two-thirds of the Buddhist teachings are based on ethical self-discipline. That's how important it is. Because without that, our mind is always going to be full of regret, and our meditation practice will never have any power, never have any power. So we have to be able to rein in the actions of our body and our speech, at least that much. The mind is going to take a while. But as Venerable says, keep your mouth shut and your hands to yourself. So that's how we rein in the body and the speech. But the mind, you know, not having greed, hatred, and ignorance, that's not easy. That's going to take a little bit of time. But that's really the ethical self-discipline is is the very basis of the very beginning of the spiritual practice, because you can't make any progress. By the way, how do we define, in some ways, well, I think I said this last time, how do you define virtue? Anybody remember what we said? So if an action, okay, if an action, we look at the result of an action. If the result of an action harms someone, that's non-virtue, including us. If a result of an action leads to happiness and is helpful, that is virtue. So we have to, we define non-virtue and virtue based on the results of a particular action. And the chief component of karma is our motivation. And that's why bodhicitta is so powerful. So enough said about that, but I think you get the point. Ethics is crucial. Then she talks about concentration, calm abiding, having a mind like a laser. So I remember George Dreyfus, who's a professor, I guess he still is at Williams College in Western Massachusetts. He came here many years ago, and George was talking about calm abiding, and he was talking about how having a mind that's so focused like a laser has such a healing effect on our psyche, has such a healing effect. Because we don't let our mind, we can focus our mind very, like a laser, the mind doesn't go off in all of these different tangents, okay? And also, when we meditate on wisdom, which is where we want to go with the meditation practice anyway, concentration in and of itself, a lot of spiritual traditions teach that practice, and they're good at it. They can focus their mind like a laser, but what they don't have is the teachings on emptiness. They don't have the profound teachings on wisdom. And so what we need is we need ethics, concentration, and wisdom. And once we develop and have some sort of intellectual understanding of wisdom, and then in meditation, we can begin to see the emptiness of self, that we see that the self that we project is a fiction, is a fictional self. Ignorance projects a false sense of I, the object of negation. So important to understand what that means, that false sense of I, and we cling to it as if it was truly existent. Okay? And what emptiness is saying is, we're void of that. We are void of that. We do exist, but just nominally. We just exist nominally. We have a mind and a body. And when they come together, we call that self. That's all there is. There's not this self, you know, this big egocentric self, the one that gets pissed off when somebody insults me, and the one that has to have everything that's wonderful and delicious. That's the self that is the ignorance, the self that's the ignorant self. And that's not the real self. The true self is the one I mentioned, the nominal self. So we've got to develop concentration. We've got to develop ethics and concentration and wisdom. When we get that, that's called nirvana. That's nirvana. Complete freedom from suffering. Okay? Complete freedom from suffering. So who wouldn't want that? Who wouldn't want that? We all want it. We all want to be happy in our heart of hearts. We want to be happy. The Dalai Lama says that we deserve to be happy. The purpose of life is to be happy. Okay? It just so happens that the way to be happy is actually to serve others. That's the true way to find true lasting happiness. Okay? So now we got a few minutes to do our Bodhisattva purification practice. And let me just say that, remember the four opponent powers? The first one was, and this is why I think it's so helpful. We really have to begin to be honest. We need to be honest with ourselves. When we've done something that is harmful, we need to come to grips with it. We don't need to make excuses for ourselves. We need to acknowledge it. So the first step in the four-pointed powers is regret. And you have to be aware of what you've done. And like I said, we've done all the 10 non-virtuous actions billions of times in countless former lifetimes. So if you might go, well, I've never killed anybody. But guess what? Former lifetime, just imagine that it's creatively aligned anyway, that you've done everything negative that's imaginable. And we need to purify that negative karma so we can be happy, so we can be free. So regret is the first one. Second one is refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, because a lot of the negativities that we've done have been done with respect to the three jewels, and then compassion for Bodhicitta, because they've also our negative actions have been done with respect directed toward other living beings. So we take refuge and develop compassion. That's the second one. The third one is the remedy. And that can be the Vajrasattva mantra that we're getting ready to do. And I don't know, some people say, we're not going to do the 100-syllable mantra. That is just too much. Unless you've memorized it, and it takes a little while to do it. I can't remember how long it took me, but it was the better part of a day to get that mantra down. But it's important. At some point in your Buddhist career, if you want to do Vajrasattva practice, to memorize the 100-syllable mantra. But we're just going to do Om Vajrasattva Hum. Om, O-M, Vajra, V-A-J-R-A, S-A-T-T-V-A, Vajrasattva Hum, H-U-M, or H-U-N-G, the Tibetans say Hum. But Om Vajrasattva Hum, okay? And we're going to say that silently. We'll start out saying it together, but then we'll say it silently. And then at the end is the determination to not do it again. Okay? That's said to be like kind of the most important thing, but it doesn't get a lot of playtime. But you have to promise as much as possible to not do it again for a minute, a second, a minute, an hour, a day, or the rest of your life, if possible. So those are the four opponent powers. So this is Lama Zopa. So get ready. Because Lama Zopa, he doesn't pull any punches. You want to pull it up? Put it up on the screen?
I only have the long mantra, actually.
Okay.
But I'm typing the short one in the chat.
All right. Well, this is the text that I'm gonna read anyway. I'll read Lama Zopa's text.
Oh, I can pull that up if you want me to. But I didn't see the short mantra in there.
No, I don't think the short mantra is in there.
Do you want me to pull up the little book?
Yeah, please.
Okay. What page are you on?
On 9.
9?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, that's good.
Oh, sorry. Here we go.
So now go down to the power of regret, just a little bit below that, right there. Okay, so first you can read this along with me, or just read it silently. But first recall the definition of negative karma, any action that results in suffering, usually an action motivated by ignorance, attachment, and aversion. Almost every action I do 24 hours a day is motivated by worldly concern, attachment to the comfort of this life. It is like from birth to death in this life. It is like this from birth to death in this life and has been like that from beginningless rebirths. Nearly every action I've ever created has been non-virtuous, the cause of suffering. Not only that, but continuously, I have been breaking my pratimoksha, bodhisattva, and tantric vows. Worst of all, I've created the heaviest of negative karmas in relation to my virtuous friends, getting angry at them, generating wrong views, having non-devotional thoughts towards them, harming their holy bodies, and disobeying their advice. Having these negative imprints on my mind's mental continuum is unbearable. It's as if I'd swallowed a lethal poison. I must practice the antidote right away and purify all this negative karma immediately, without a second's delay. In this way, generate strong feelings of urgency and regret. And by the way, remember, we talked about how karma is definite. Like positive always leads to suffering, positive always leads to happiness, negative to suffering, but then karma is expandable. So we have to have a sense of urgency that we need to purify. This is why it's so important to do this practice before you go to bed at night anyway, just to clean off your day. So in this way, generate strong feelings of urgency and regret. Then remembering impermanence and death. Many people my age or younger have died. It's a miracle that I'm still alive and have this incredible opportunity to purify my negative karma. Death is certain, and its time is most uncertain. If I were to die right now, I would definitely be born in the lower realms. Because I could not practice Dharma there, I would remain in the lower realms for countless eons. Therefore, how unbelievably fortunate I am to be able to purify my negative karma right now without even a second's delay by practicing the Vajrasattva meditation recitation. And the power of dependence, generating bodhicitta. But I'm not practicing this Vajrasattva purification for myself alone. The purpose of my life is to release all hell beings, pretas. These words may not mean anything to you, but these are the six realms of samsara. To release all hell beings, pretas, animals, humans, asuras, insuras, and intermediate state beings from all of their suffering and its causes, and lead them to the unsurpassed enlightenment. In order to do this, I must first reach enlightenment myself. Therefore, I must purify all my negative karma immediately by practicing the Vajrasattva meditation recitation. Above the crown of my head, seated upon a lotus and a moon seat, are Vajrasattva father and mother. Now, you don't have the picture of that here, but it's actually a Hastayoga Tantra image of Vajrasattva father and mother, the male and female deity in sexual union. But that symbolizes a union of method and wisdom. It's not, you know, what you think it is. It's much, much more powerful than that. But Lama Zopa chose that image for this book because Hastayoga Tantra is the most powerful practice to help us purify negative karma. So, above the crown of my head, seated upon a lotus and moon seat, are Vajrasattva father and mother. Their bodies are white. Each has one face and two arms. He holds a Dorjian bell, and she holds a curved knife and a skull cup. They're embracing each other. The father is adorned with six mudras, and the mother with five. Mudras are, well, I'm not going to go into that. He sits in the Vajra posture, she in the lotus. Vajrasattva is Maru Guru, the holy mind of all the Buddhas, the Dharmakaya, who out of his unbearable compassion, which embraces me and all other sentient beings, appears in this form to purify me and all others. In this way, your mind is transformed into Guru devotion, the root of all blessings and realizations to the path to enlightenment. On a moon disk at Vajrasattva's heart. So now we imagine that Vajrasattva, father and mother, they're sitting on a lotus, a sun and a moon disk, right? And they're completely made of light, and they symbolize, and they are, we need to think of them as a living presence. They're actually Buddhas inseparable from our root guru, okay? And at their heart, and again, you can't do this first time you try, but you imagine at their heart stands a moon disk, And at the center of the moon disk is the letter or the word hum, H-U-M. Now, there's a Sanskrit word. It's quite beautiful, and you know, it's like. But anyway, we can just visualize it as H-U-M sitting in the center of the moon disk at Vajrasattva's heart, encircled by a garland of the 100-syllable mantra. And in our case, we're just going to imagine Om Vajrasattva Hum, and imagine that that's the 100-syllable mantra. A powerful stream of white nectar flows from the hum and the mantra garland, and I am cleansed of all sickness, spirit harm, negative karma, and obscurations. Now, I'll just read this out loud one time, but the meaning of it is, you can just think of it as the meaning of it, in essence, is purifying your body, speech, and mind of all of your negativities. But the way you would say this, and there's a nice tune, which I can never remember, but it's Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manupalaya Vajrasattva Dino Patita Dido Mebawa Sutokayo Mebawa Supukayo Mebawa Adarakyo Mebawa Sora Siddhi Me Prayacha Sora Kama Sucha Me Chidam Sriyam Kuruham Ha 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 Ho Bhagawan Sora Tathagata Vajra Mami Mucha Vajra Bawa Masamaya Safa Ahum Pe. And so, if you were going to do this mantra 100,000 times, that's a 100-syllable mantra. You would say that 100,000 times, but you would say it much, much faster than I just did. Now, we recite the mantra 7 or 21 times or as many times as possible, practicing the three techniques of downward cleansing, upward cleansing, and instantaneous cleansing. So go a little bit forward, past the right there. Go backward a little bit. Yeah. Or they're right there. Recite the mantra 7 or 21 times, or many times, practicing the three techniques. Downward cleansing, imagining that the nectar, light and nectar coming from Vajrasattva above the crown of our head is entering the crown of our head and completely purifying our body of all of its diseases and negativities. All the negative karma of body is completely purified, and it goes out through the lower orifices of our body and disappears in space beneath us. So that's purifying the negative karma of body. The upward cleansing is like, it's like our body is like a glass, but at the top are little holes, and the holes are our ears and our eyes and our mouth and our nostrils. And we imagine that our body is just fills up with this light and nectar, and all of the negativity of speech rises up on this sort of this nectar. It's on the surface of the nectar, like oil on water, you might say, and it spills out these little holes. And we imagine, as we say the mantra, we're purifying our negative karma of speech. That's the upward cleansing. And the instantaneous cleansing is, we'll say it, we'll do this 7 times with the downward cleansing, 7 times with the upward cleansing, and 7 times with instantaneous cleansing. Instantaneous cleansing, imagining that the light and nectar enters the crown of our head, and the instant it enters our body, completely purifies all the negative karma of our mind. All the negative karma that we've ever created, from countless eons till now, completely purified. Okay? So let's do this together. And I'm gonna do the, wait a minute. Yeah. There we go. So we're gonna do it 7 times together. And we'll do just Om Vajrasattva Hum. So imagine above the crown of your head is Vajrasattva, father and mother, and that there's a moon disk at their heart with the hums at the center, and around the edge is Om Vajra Svaha Hum. As we say the mantra, light and nectar come from that, from the hum and the mantra garland down through the body of Vajrasattva, father and mother, entering the crown of our head. And the first seven is purifying the negative karma of our body. So it goes completely through our body. So Om Vajrasattva Hum, 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 Om Vajrasattva Hum. And now imagine that your negative karma of your body completely purified. All the negative karma of your body from the beginning of beginningless time completely purified. Now we're going to do the upward cleansing, right? Where the where it purifies our speech. Om Vajrasattva Hum, 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 Om Vajrasattva Hum. And now imagine that all the negative karma, not in just this life, but in countless former lifetimes, completely purifying, so that we don't have to experience the negative consequences of that, of those former actions of negative speech. And now we're going to do the instantaneous purification of mental negative karma. Om Vajrasattva Hum, 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 Om Vajrasattva Hum. And now imagine that all the negative karma of our mind is completely purified. And now you can go, yeah, from now go down to the, where it says generating faith and having been purified. Yeah, right there. From the crown of my head, Guru Vajrasattva says, son of the race, your negativities, obscurations, and broken and damaged pledges have been completely purified. Generate strong faith that they have been completely purified, just as Guru Vajrasattva has said. Now the power of refraining from creating negative karma again. Before Guru Vajrasattva, I vow never again to commit those negative actions from which I can easily abstain, and not to commit them for a day, an hour, or at least a few seconds, those negative actions from which I find it difficult to abstain. Now the absorption. So now Guru Vajrasattva, father and mother, okay, Guru Vajrasattva is extremely pleased with your pledge. Vajrasattva, father and mother, melt into light and dissolve into you, and your body, speech, and mind become inseparably one with Guru Vajrasattva's holy body, speech, and mind. And feel that your body, speech, and mind are pure and oneness with Guru Vajrasattva's holy body, speech, and mind. Now, we're using our imagination, it's true, but we can try to feel this. See what it feels like to be completely pure, body, speech, and mind. And now we'll do the dedication. In emptiness, there is no I, creative negative karma. There is no action of creating negative karma, and there's no negative karma created. Place your mind in that emptiness for a little while. In this way, look at all phenomena as empty. They do not exist from their own side. With this awareness of emptiness, dedicate the merits. Due to all the merits of the three times collected by me, Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, and all other sentient beings which appear to be real from their, but which are empty, May I, which appears to be real but is empty, achieve Guru Vajrasattva's enlightenment, which appears to be real but is empty, and lead all sentient beings who appear to be real but are totally empty to that enlightenment which appears to be real but is empty, for by myself alone, which appears to be real but is also totally empty, non-existent from there. May the precious bodhicitta, the source of all happiness and success, for myself and all other sentient beings, be generated within my mind stream and in the minds of all sentient beings without even a second's delay. And may that which has been generated be increased. May I and all other sentient beings like have Lama Tsongkhapa as our direct guru in all our lifetimes, never be separated for even a second from the pure path that is greatly praised by the conqueror Buddhas, and actualize the complete path, the three principles and the two higher stages of highest yoga tantra, the root of which is guru devotion within our minds as quickly as possible. Just as the brave Manjushri and Sumantra Bhadra realize things as they are, I dedicate all these virtues to the best way that I may follow after them. Whatever dedication the three times virtuous ones gone to bliss have admired as best, in the same way may I also perfectly dedicate all these roots of virtue so that I may perform good works. Amen. So that's our dedication for tonight. And I lost track of time, so whatever time it is, it just is that time. So thank you for your attention. And this next week is, I mean, we have one more week, right? Isn't next Monday the last class?
That's correct.
Yeah. So your job the next week, you got a little work to do here. I thought we were going to have more time. Anyway, you got a little work to do. Do the path of the advanced practitioner. So you might want to do two or three meditations a day so that you can get through generating bodhicitta and then the six perfections, okay? So there's a lot of juice there, but it's F1 through F9 and then G1 through G9. Now, you can pick the ones that resonate with you the most. I'm not going to make a big deal out of it. But if you can get through all of these, and again, you don't have to do them. The class doesn't have to be over for you next Monday. You can continue to do these guided meditations about Jupiter Children for as long as you find them helpful. So thank you. And I appreciate your presence and your, you know, making this class happen. I always enjoy, I always get more out of the class than I would if I was just sitting on the other side. So very helpful for me that you show up and have a good week and practice hard. And but just one day at a time, remember that. All you have to do is just one day at a time. All right, so we're all done.
Back down. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you, John. Have a good one.
Bye-bye. Thank you.